Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, has some of the toughest gun control law in the country. Now, that gun control is being challenged in the case that goes tomorrow before the U.S. Supreme Court. It's the first time in nearly 70 years that the High Court will take up the Second Amendment and the supercharged issue of the right to bear arms. This hour, On Point, gun control and gun rights before the Supreme Court. Joining me first today from Washington is Emily Bazelon, senior editor and legal analyst for Slate magazine. She writes for Slate's new law blog, Convictions, which launches today. Emily, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Can you please tell us about the case that comes before the court for opening arguments tomorrow?
This is a case brought by a plaintiff named Dick Heller, and his complaint is that he wants to be able to have a gun in his house that he can use for self-defense. And the District of Columbia has the most restrictive home gun ownership law in the country. You're not allowed to have a handgun at all. And if you have a shotgun or a rifle, you have to keep it unloaded or disassembled with a trigger lock, and the trigger lock takes about a minute to undo. So Heller's argument is that if there were actually an intruder, he would be pretty handicapped in trying to respond with his gun.
So what is the status of the case at the moment? What brings it to the Supreme Court?
Well, for years and years, the court hasn't ruled in this area, and there was an assumption based on this 1939 case that there is no individual right to bear arms protected by the Second Amendment. But in the last several years, there's been some revisionist scholarship, including by some liberal thinkers in the legal academy, that has questioned that assumption. And the District of Columbia Federal Court of Appeals has ruled in this case that, in fact, there is an individual right to bear arms protected by the Second Amendment, and has, in a pretty broad ruling, struck down the District of Columbia's gun ban.
So I think a lot of Americans would be surprised to hear that there's an assumption of no individual right to bear arms. That may be the last ruling of the Supreme Court, but that seems really at variance with the way it's discussed in this country today and for some time now.
Well, I think that's true. And one reason, arguably, is that when the framers wrote the Constitution in the 18th century, they were thinking about a world in which there was an individual right to bear arms. And people assumed that you needed a gun in your house to protect yourself against intruders, but also against too much power on the behalf of the government. And that strain of thinking, I think, has stayed with us. And then groups like the National Rifle Association have been very successful in persuading people that this is an important right that needs to be protected.
Emily, what's on the line here in practical terms? We're going to go through the arguments in this hour, but in practical terms, first of all, for the District of Columbia and its gun control law, will it have to be scrapped, thrown out, if the lower court's ruling is upheld?
Yes. If the lower court's ruling is upheld, it would be pretty hard for the Supreme Court to keep the District of Columbia's law, unless they go off in this sort of possible but kind of weird tangent, which would be to say that because the District of Columbia is not a state, the Second Amendment just doesn't apply there. That's possible, but I think unlikely.
And what about larger implications for gun control and regulation of firearms around the country, federally, state by state, city by city?
Well, this is really the important part of this case, the most important for most of the rest of the country. And in with regard to other gun control laws, the court could issue a ruling in this case that says, okay, D.C. has gone too far because you really can't have an operative gun in your house. But that doesn't mean that a lot of other more moderate gun control bans, like registration requirements and waiting periods, aren't consonant with an individual right to bear arms in the Second Amendment.
Where has the federal government weighed in on this, the Bush administration? What are they saying to the court as it prepares to consider this case?
Well, that's become a really fascinating part of this case, because the Justice Department of the Bush administration has weighed in sort of along the lines I was just talking about, to say, yes, the D.C. court's decision should be upheld and there is an individual right to bear arms in the Second Amendment. But that right allows for a lot of reasonable regulation, including congressional bans on machine guns and various and the rights of felons to bear arms, regulations like that. But Vice President Dick Cheney signed a separate brief in which he argued for a much broader ruling that would strike down a much larger number of gun control regulations.
So Vice President Cheney has signed on to an argument that is in opposition to the Justice Department?
Exactly. That is the sort of strange posture of this case as it goes up to the Supreme Court.
What do we know? The court, of course, has turned over a few times since 1939. Is there a sense of how the court is likely to break down in considering this case?
Well, in the strictest sense, we have no idea because none of these nine justices have ruled in a guns case. In fact, we know that some of these justices, in particular Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas, are big textualists, which means that they like to look at the original words in the Constitution and what they think those words meant in the 18th century. And when you look at the recent wave of scholarship, there's a pretty good case that the framers were talking about an individual right to bear arms. And so you imagine them going in that direction. And I would imagine Sam Alito and John Roberts also being very sympathetic to that point of view. And so then the question is, will the court sort of right-to-center Justice Anthony Kennedy agree with them? And will the four liberal moderates on the court possibly also agree with an individual right to bear arms, but really push hard for a lot of room for regulation? And will that view end up holding sway and getting five votes?
Now, we know the National Rifle Association, the NRA, has been very strong in promoting the individual's right to bear arms. You say that some liberal scholars have come down in that terrain as well. Like whom?
Well, Larry Tribe, who is a Harvard law professor who's written extensively on the Bill of Rights, has basically said, yes, there is an individual right to bear arms in the Second Amendment. Now, he's also very clearly on the record, particularly recently in light of this case, as saying, look, that historical view does not mean that you have to strike down particular gun control regulation, even the District of Columbia's law. And then there's some other scholars like Sandy Levinson, who also have sort of weighed in that direction.
But overall, though, the basic understanding is what's being considered here. Are people imagining that a year from now we may have to be doing wholesale rewriting of gun control laws around this country as a result of what comes out of the high court?
Well, that is certainly possible, and that's a really interesting prospect because if that happens, it will be because a conservative court really went back to the Constitution, made a very broad ruling, and scrapped a lot of legislative work. And that whole premise is at odds with the notion of judicial restraint and the whole idea that you don't want activist judges running around making lots of rules that fly in the face of democratically arrived at decisions. So if that happens, it will really be kind of breathtaking sight.
First time in a long time we have such a big, high-profile consideration of the Second Amendment. Emily Bazelon, senior editor and legal analyst at Slate, where you can see their new blog, Convictions, launching today. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to go now to Columbus, Ohio, and Saul Cornell. He's a professor of history at Ohio State University. He's director of the Second Amendment Research Center and author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control. Professor Cornell, thanks very much for joining us.
Tom, thanks for having me.
Is it this fundamental argument that you see us about to hear before the Supreme Court of whether this is an individual right or a collective right related to a militia? Is that what we're about to see hashed out?
Well, it's funny you should frame it that way. It is certainly true that for most of the 20th century, the debate was framed as an individual versus a collective right. But what's really very interesting about this case, in which history is very much at the center, and ironically, you have historians lining up against the individual rights interpretation largely, and you have law professors and a few historians who are not experts in early American history siding with the individual rights view. But if you actually look at what the court has said, they framed it in a completely different way. They have basically framed it as follows. Does the right of the people that the Second Amendment protects, does it protect guns that have no connection to the militia and that are used for completely private purposes, or does it protect guns that have to have some connection with a well-regulated militia?
So,
and that's very different than the individual collective rights framing, because you actually don't see anyone who's supporting the District of Columbia using the language of collective rights, which I think is very interesting.
That's interesting, and we will probe it. But what does that mean in practical terms, that a Saturday night special would not be covered, but a rifle that you could pick off redcoats with would be?
Well, I think we want to stay away from the sort of anachronism argument where you say that the only guns that are protected would be muskets, because we would want to apply that logic to the First Amendment. But it is true that that if you look at the language, and it's interesting that we've already spoke about textualism, it really parsing the words very closely, because what we're talking about is guns that further the goal of a well-regulated militia. That's actually what that 1939 Miller case talked about. And the key question really is, does each individual get to decide for himself what gun they need to further that purpose? Or is this something that we've given our legislatures the power to decide, and it's up to them to constitute the kind of militia that they think we need and what kind of weapons we need in order to participate in that militia?
Do you expect a major challenge to existing gun control regulations to come out of a Supreme Court decision? Is that possible here?
Well, of course, it is always possible. But of course, the great irony, and there are so many rich ironies in this particular debate, in this particular case, is that virtually 99% of the scholarship and indeed most of the briefs that are filed in defense of Heller focus about history or, to a limited extent, public policy. But very few of them have actually focused on what standard of review you should use. And in fact, that's probably how the case is going to be decided. Are we going to analogize this to property rights or commercial speech, or in fact give it the highest kind of protection that we give to political speech?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about gun control and the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, going before the Supreme Court tomorrow for the first time in nearly 70 years in a big way. We've been joined from Ohio State University by Saul Cornell, history professor at Ohio State, director of the Second Amendment Research Center. We're joined as well right now by Nicholas Quinn Rosencrantz. He's a law professor at Georgetown University, former advisor at the Office of Legal Counsel in the U.S. Department of Justice. He's clerked for Justice Kennedy. Nicholas Rosencrantz, thanks very much for being with us today.
Very happy to be with you.
How do you see the stakes and the heart of the issue as the Supreme Court takes up the Second Amendment tomorrow?
Well, as Emily explained, the D.C. Gun control regulations are the most severe in the country. So they actually amount essentially to a ban on possession of handguns,
mm-hmm.
Even in one's home for self-defense, even moving a gun from room to room. These are very, very strict gun control laws. And these are the laws that are at issue before the court. So if the court chooses to strike down D.C.'s gun control laws, not at all clear what other laws will be in jeopardy. It may well be that most of the gun control regulations across the country will still stand.
Do you see the Supreme Court shifting its support from a collective understanding of the right to bear arms to a definition that sees it as an individual right to bear arms in this consideration, Nick?
Well, I do predict that they will endorse an individual rights view, although I wouldn't say that that's a shift. They actually haven't taken a position on this one way or the other. So this will be really the first time that the Supreme Court actually takes a crack at that question. And yes, I do predict that they'll say that the Second Amendment protects an individual right.
Saul Cornell, do you agree? Where does the highest legal interpretation of the Constitution stand right now before whatever the court does next? Is it in the collective camp or the individual camp?
Well, reading Supreme Court tea leaves is always notoriously difficult. I think there's certainly many people who believe that the most likely outcome is for the court to accept some version of the individual rights view, but will focus on the level of regulation. And it's most likely they will not accept the lower court's ruling, that they will either opt for something close to the intermediate level of scrutiny recommended by the federal government, or possibly even the standard that is actually used uniformly across the rest of the country and has been the standard for almost all of American history, which is gun laws should be evaluated by a reasonableness test.
But if it's individual rights that come out as the sort of operative understanding, is that a shift or is that where we are now, Saul?
Well, I think the standard interpretation of what the New Deal era case Miller established was a collective rights view. Although in my book, I argue that Miller is actually closer to the 19th century interpretation, which is a militia-based view, that the measure of what kind of gun gets protected and of who gets to claim a Second Amendment right is tied to the preamble to the affirmation of the purpose of a well-regulated militia and of the other goal of promoting the security of a free state. Now, whether that makes it an individual right, a collective right, a civic right, or something in between is sort of a semantic issue. I think the really important question is this about a gun sitting in your dresser table, or is this about the kind of guns you need if you're going to participate in the militia?
Second Amendment, which of course refers to a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Nick Rosenkranz, is it your understanding then that the currently operating view is that it's a collective right? I know that's not the NRA view. That's not this sort of a way we talk about it anymore. But in purely legal terms, is that where it stands before this next consideration?
Well, again, the court really hasn't decided this question. So the court has spoken.
Well, there's 1939 standing there.
1939, in this case called Miller, the discussion of the Second Amendment is very brief in that case and very cryptic. I'd say both sides of this debate have sort of claimed Miller as supporting their position, but the court hardly took on this question. So the court did not say, we are deciding between an individual rights and collective rights vision of the Second Amendment, and we decide X. They really dealt with this question only in passing and didn't nail down the answer to this in 1939 at all.
So if you expect it now to be nailed down toward an individual right, what about Saul Cornell's view that then the question is, well, how much can that right be regulated, and is it regulated around the type of firearm? Do you share that view, Nick?
Well, it's absolutely right that if there is an individual right, the question will be, is that individual right subject to reasonable regulations? I think virtually everyone agrees that it will be subject to reasonable regulations. And then the question will be, what constitutes a reasonable regulation? So what about registration requirements? What about trigger locks? What about waiting periods before purchasing handguns? And which sorts of guns are covered, pistols or machine guns or et cetera? These will all be difficult questions, and these will all be questions that the court sort of will work out in due time as it develops this doctrine. But for this case, the court doesn't actually have to nail down those questions, because in D.C., what we have is an outright ban. So all the court has to say here is, we're not sure what a reasonable regulation would be, but an outright ban goes too far. And that, I think, is all the court will say at this point.
And what's the gap that we see here between Vice President Cheney, let's say, and what he's signed on to and expressed to the court, and the Solicitor General, Paul D. Clement? Is Cheney for or against reasonable regulation, or a different degree of regulation than the Justice Department is arguing here?
Well, Emily's right that this is an interesting aspect of the case. The Solicitor General, Paul Clement, filed a brief saying that the court should remand this case to the D.C. Circuit. So not affirm what the D.C. Circuit did, but send it back to them to think about it again with a view toward a more permissive standard for regulation.
In other words, to permit more regulation. Okay.
To permit more regulation. Now, the brief strongly suggests that it thinks D.C.'s laws should fall anyway, but it wants to make clear that it thinks the standard should be a bit different from what the D.C. Circuit said.
And then the vice president, he who has shot his buddy in the face hunting, what's he have to say?
So the Solicitor General's brief annoyed a number of people, you know, the NRA and guns rights people, that the administration didn't strongly support the D.C. Circuit's position on this. Many congressmen, I think it's 55 mm-hmm. senators and a big number of congressmen, filed an amicus brief saying we should just affirm what the D.C. Circuit did. So we should just say that the D.C. Circuit got this exactly right and just affirm. And Vice President Cheney signed on to that. Now, the odd feature is Vice President Cheney signs on to it in his capacity as president of the Senate. So that's why you're able to get two different positions, one from the Solicitor General and one from Dick Cheney, because Dick Cheney here is wearing a different hat. He's wearing his hat as president of the Senate, not as vice president of the United States.
Well, that bright orange hunting cap, maybe. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join the conversation. Let's go to Manchester, Vermont, and Mike. Mike, you're on the air with Saul Cornell and Nicholas Rosenkranz.
Hi, it's Manchester, New Hampshire, but that's good.
Sorry.
That's okay. Militia. I'm in the National Guard. I touch my rifle only a couple times a year. It's under lock and key in the rack, in the cage, in the vault. So I don't think there's a militia that exists today. So how can one argue that there's a collective right when there's no collective?
Saul, what do you say?
Well, there's no question that the Founding Fathers had this Minuteman view of the militia that actually was as much an obligation as it was a right. You could be fined if you didn't muster. You were prescribed as to what type of weapon you had, how it had to be stored. And I think the great dirty secret in the whole debate is that nobody really wants the original Second Amendment, because that would involve us all dropping what we're doing on a moment's notice, mustering, and potentially going off to Iraq on a moment's notice, which now, if you're in the National Guard, that's a possibility. But I don't think everyone wants to live in that kind of world. So the problem is that we don't have that militia anymore because we don't want it. We could recreate that militia tomorrow, but it would actually involve more gun regulation and more intrusion into our lives, not less, which is the dirty secret that gun rights people don't really want to acknowledge. Now, on the other side, gun control people I don't think want to see us living in a more militarized society either. So really nobody wants the original Second Amendment. And what's so funny is the briefs in this case disproportionately talk about the original Second Amendment, yet no one really wants it.
Nicholas Rosenkranz, what about it then? If we don't have that kind of militia anymore, how does a textualist look at this particular amendment if the context is gone, so changed?
Well, so the Second Amendment has two clauses. Second Amendment says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. That's like the preamble clause. It's mm-hmm. like a prefatory clause. And then you get to the operative clause. So a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. You know, I think what we'd say is there's a preamble here which states a particular kind of civic purpose. But then the operative language is written much more broadly than that, and it's written as an individual right, which sounds a lot like the other individual rights in the Bill of Rights. So the right of the people to keep and bear arms. And noteworthy that it's not just bear arms, but actually keep and bear arms. And that's the right that the people are arguing for in Heller, is the right to keep arms in their homes for self-defense.
Saul Cornell, you describe the militia, you know, that if it were around today, might involve going off to Iraq. We talked earlier with Sanford Levinson, who's down at the University of Texas Law School, and he was saying that the Second Amendment is, in a way, a kind of scary part of the Constitution, his words, insofar as scholars who look at it often agree that it had to also to do with empowering the collective people to overthrow their own government using those arms. How does that factor in here, Professor Cornell?
Well, there's two things to point out. In terms of the language of the amendment, the purpose clause or the preamble clause and the operative clause are not really talking about something different. If you look at the use of the phrase bear arms in the 18th century, we now have actually good scholarship on this that has exhaustively looked at every use of that word. And in something over 95% of the cases, it's used to describe a civic military purpose. There are some exceptions, and some of them are interesting, but the standard rule of construction in the era of the Constitution was you use the orthodox, not the idiosyncratic or minority view of the language. And I think what's hard for us to accept is that in the 18th century, the notion that a state would mobilize its militia and have it march on Washington in order to assert a check on the federal government is kind of horrifying to us, because we fought a civil war to make sure that didn't happen. Mm. But in fact, that almost happened in 1800 when Thomas Jefferson spoke to the governors of both Virginia and Pennsylvania, and they were ready to mobilize the militia in order to force Congress to make Jefferson the president. So instead of Bush v. Gore in 1800, we had the militia being used to try and finish the political process. So it is in some ways a terrifying amendment, an amendment that speaks to a world of the 18th century where fears of standing armies are what everyone is afraid of, and it's a very distant world to the one we live in.
Of course, these days, the terror can be on quite a different side, whether it's Northern Illinois University, where we saw all those students killed just last month, or Virginia Tech a year ago, 32 people plus himself, the gunman killed there. Let's go to Waterbury, Connecticut, and James. James, you're on the air.
Hi, hi. Thanks for having me today.
Yes.
Well, you know, I am a gun owner for 10 years, and, you know, I do use the right because, you know, we have the right. But what I think is time was 2008, about 2009, I think it's time for our country to grow up and get out of the fact that we live in back in the Civil War days when we're still creating a country. We do not need the right to bear arms anymore. That's my opinion. Because for what reason? Why don't they discuss the fact of, don't the people have the right to walk down the street without having to worry about getting shot by someone that has an illegal weapon or that was a stolen weapon? It's time to get rid of the weapons, and then we can start cleaning our streets, and then we can start showing the world that we are a peaceful country, and we are going to try to better ourselves, and there's no reason for violence, and there's no reason for weapons because we don't believe in that anymore.
James, you said you had a gun for 10 years. What kind of gun do you own?
I own a pistol.
Why did you buy it?
Well, you know, I did want to be an officer when I was 20 years old, so I was going through all that kind of stuff when I was a kid. And then I was like, you know, we have the right to have a weapon. Actually, I've never even shot it. I probably only shot it once, and that was at a target range. And I haven't shot it for 9 years now. You know, and the reason why people say, oh, we need guns to protect ourselves. Listen, if someone's going to shoot you, they're going to shoot you if they're coming to rob your house. Look at what happened in Cheshire, Connecticut. These people came in there and destroyed a whole family.
The big home invasion. Yeah, our time is short before the break. Nicholas Quinn Rosenkrantz, what do you say to James' perspective?
Well, I'd say two things. One is there's some real compelling scholarship that gun control laws do not actually make us safer. So when you have really strict gun control laws, the argument runs, law-abiding people cannot have guns to protect themselves, but there are still illegal guns on the streets. So if you allow law-abiding citizens to also have guns, you actually end up with less crime. Now, that's certainly a debatable point, but there's some compelling scholarship on that side. And then to his other point, you know, maybe he's right that it's time to get rid of the right to bear arms, but that's not what's at issue in this case. If there's a movement to amend the Constitution to get rid of the Second Amendment, that would be the sort of argument we would have then. But this is not about amending the Constitution. This is about interpreting the Constitution that we have now. And the Constitution we have now has a Second Amendment with a right to keep and bear arms.
Saul Cornell, do you see this case as a rally the troops moment for the NRA side or the gun control side or the, you know, abolish the Second Amendment gang, if James has got one going in Connecticut, or is this just tweaking?
Well, I don't know that there's a large abolish the Second Amendment movement in America. I think most Americans are proud of the Constitution, and the Second Amendment makes a lot of sense in terms of the fears that the Founding Fathers had. I do think that the point that Nicholas made about the evidence in terms of the complicated public policy literature, the reason that this is a bad thing for a court to get into is it's very complicated to weigh exactly how public policy effects will change the calculus of safety versus the right of self-defense. And that's why we want legislatures, not courts, making these kind of decisions. The great danger in this case is that we will take away from legislatures the tools they need to try and experiment and come up with the best policies that can both protect us and do a minimal amount of restriction on lawful gun ownership. I mean, we need to respect the fact that guns are an important part of America, but so is gun regulation.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about gun control and the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, going before the Supreme Court for the first time in nearly 70 years tomorrow. Professor Saul Cornell has joined us from Ohio State University. He's director of the Second Amendment Research Center. Nicholas Quinn Rosenkrantz joins us from the Georgetown University. He's a professor of law there, former advisor at the Office of Legal Counsel in the U.S. Department of Justice, and clerked for Justice Kennedy on the Supreme Court. We're joined right now from Bristol, Rhode Island, by Professor Carl Bogus, law professor at Roger Williams University. He supports a collective rights view of the Second Amendment. He's author of The Second Amendment in Law and History. Professor Bogus, thanks very much for being here.
Pleasure being with you, Tom.
Give us a background on this case that has ended up before the Supreme Court. Where did it come from, and how do you see it being played out, or being played, maybe is a better way of putting it, from your perspective?
The case arose out of the District of Columbia. The now sole remaining plaintiff, Heller, is a guard who works at the Federal Judicial Center. He carries a gun as part of his job, a handgun, and he wishes to have that handgun, he wishes to be able to keep that handgun, and he says also a long gun at home for personal self-defense. He can't do that because in 1976, the District of Columbia passed a set of laws that effectively ban private handgun ownership within the District of Columbia. And he claims that that law violates his Second Amendment right. He claims that the right is an individual right, not a right to keep and bear arms within the government militia, but a right of individuals to have guns for self-defense. And he also says, and the Court of Appeals agreed with him, not only for self-defense, but as an ultimate check on governmental tyranny, the argument being that if the federal government were to become tyrannical, the Second Amendment, he claims, gives people a right to be armed to go to war with their own government should it become tyrannical.
But give us a sense of how the powers that be array around this security guard. Has the NRA been involved in pushing this forward? I understand there's been others who have taken a significant interest.
Yes, the principal engineer of this litigation is a fellow at the Libertarian Cato Institute, who is not a gun rights advocate, but an advocate for a libertarian point of view, which worships the individual and is skeptical, if not hostile, to government regulation of all kinds. And in this case, that's the ideology, the philosophy or the ideology that's behind the people who are pushing the case.
And this is a wealthy individual who has helped push this forward. The NRA, do they want to see this individual liberty asserted by the high court or not?
Well, they claim they do, but it's been a long time, decades, where the NRA has claimed that they wish to defend the individual rights theory in the courts. And since 1939, the law has been pretty well settled, up until 1991 anyway, that the Second Amendment only grants a collective right, or as Professor Cornell would call it, a civic right, or others would call it a militia-based right, but whatever you call it, it's a right of the people to keep and bear arms only within the government-regulated militia. And it's been a long time that the NRA has been saying, well, we wish to overturn that in the courts. However, my somewhat cynical view is that their heart was never in it, because should they have overturned it in the courts and finally vindicated the individual rights theory, then they would have lost their ability to bang the drums for their crusade they would have won.
Right. It would be over. Now, in this case, do you expect the court to line up behind the individual right theory of the case or not? And if they do, what are the long-term implications of that for gun ownership and control in this country?
Well, it is a precarious undertaking to predict what the Supreme Court will do. We have a hint only from two of the nine justices, and those are Scalia and Thomas. Scalia made a comment in a book he wrote. Thomas, a comment in another case that didn't deal directly with the Second Amendment. But their comments or their hints suggest that they wanted to take a Second Amendment case and change the Supreme Court doctrine from collective right to individual right. But that leaves seven justices we don't know anything about. During his confirmation hearings, now Chief Justice Roberts made some comments that suggested that he leaned toward the individual right, but I don't think that anybody attaches great importance to that because they were brief and they were pretty much, how shall I put this, DOJ, Department of Justice talking points, and the Department of Justice had briefed him for his hearings, and he hadn't rolled his sleeves up and dealt with this topic at any length.
A lot of history here, maybe a fork in the road tomorrow. Tom's calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Tom, you're on the air. What do you think?
Thank you for taking my call. I have a concealed carry permit, and I'm a life member of the National Rifle Association.
Do you use that permit, Tom? Do you use it? Do you carry a concealed weapon?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm former military, but I believe that the right to keep and bear arms is an individual right. But my big problem is that I find that a lot of people that have arms have no training and no criminal background investigation into their ability to own weapons. We require people to have license to drive cars and fly aircraft. I think any reasonable person should submit to complete background vetting with fingerprints in order to own a weapon. And once they have been vetted and once they've shown that they have some training in the use and safety of that weapon, they should be able to buy a gun in any state they want to go to.
And you say that as an NRA member. Nicholas Rosenkranz, does that line up with your understanding of what the amendment guarantees?
I think that probably is consistent with what the amendment guarantees. So, again, in this case, what we have is an outright ban. And all the court's going to have to decide in this case is whether an outright ban is okay. If the court says an outright ban is not okay, it's still possible for all sorts of regulations to be permissible, including all sorts of permitting requirements, all sorts of background checks and whatnot. And I think the court will say that reasonable regulations are fine, and I suspect that lower courts and the court in a future case will say that those sorts of regulations would be fine.
But Saul Cornell, exactly that kind of background check and vetting has been fought tooth and nail by the NRA for years and rather successfully in many communities. It leaves me wondering if maybe the Supreme Court is the least of institutions when it comes to this. Maybe this is really being played out, more importantly, at a political level all over.
Well, there's no question it's being played out at a political level. For one thing, many, many states have constitutional provisions where the right to keep and bear arms is expressly framed as an individual right. That political battle, I think, is where much of gun regulation occurs at the state level and in the state legislatures. It is interesting that the District of Columbia's position in this is, in fact, this is not a ban on firearms. This is a ban on a particular category of firearms. So the interesting question is, does whatever theory of the Second Amendment you hold, does the Second Amendment create a firearms bazaar where you have to have any gun you want and any number of guns you want? Or could government say certain weapons, machine guns or handguns in certain jurisdictions, don't actually restrict you unduly because you have access to other kinds of weapons? I mean, that's really what's fascinating, is the District of Columbia has actually said that Heller is entitled to having a functional firearm, although it has to be stored safely. They're just saying he can't have a handgun.
But then we get to potential restrictions on what can be had. Our caller says, don't restrict the guns, vet the people. How do these arguments relate to the argument of whether or not this is like freedom of speech, a more absolute right?
Well, I think that guns have never been treated like words. I mean, that defies common sense. And actually, historically, you had all kinds of prior restraints on firearms ownership and use that you would never have had on speech, even at the time of the Second Amendment. In fact, amazingly enough, Boston, the city in which this show originates, had a law that said you couldn't have a loaded firearm in any home or domestic building in the city. So actually half
when,
of the
when
DC,
did it have that?
Well, actually, in 1786, they passed a law that said you could not have a loaded firearm in the city of Boston. Hmm. In fact, that means that half of the gun law at stake in this D.C. case was thought to be constitutional by the very same people who drafted the Second Amendment. So the only issue I think that there's any question is whether a ban on certain categories of firearms is too broad. The issue of whether or not you can force someone to store a gun safely, which most sensible gun owners store their gun safely. Mm-hmm. So it defies reason to think that you couldn't do that. If you can't do that, you probably can't have child safety seats in cars or pass speed limits on the highways. I mean, these are the kinds of things that reasonable regulations include. And I think most gun owners are like the caller. Most gun owners want to see background checks, they want to see mandatory safety training, they want to see safe storage laws, but we can't even get those passed in America, and that is really the great tragedy.
Let's go to Exeter, Rhode Island, and Jerry. Hi, Jerry, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question or my concern is that let's suppose that they determined that the Second Amendment is a collective right, and those weapons that are allowed to be owned by the individual are suitable only for arming a militia.
It seems unlikely they're going that way, but okay.
Okay, but let's just say they do that.
Yep.
Now, haven't we taken one interpretation and placed another one on top of that? Who decides what weapons are suitable for a militia and those that are not? And this, aren't we, again, bouncing against, let's say, for example, the assault weapon ban of a few years ago? Basically, all semi-automatic weapons that had either a pistol grip, a flash suppressor, or a bayonet lug were basically outlawed. Now, those kind of weapons are surely suitable for a militia, but yet we banned them at one point in time. I think when the Second Amendment was written, it was pretty obvious what type of weapons would be suitable for a militia. That was basically everything they had.
Yeah.
And we had no idea back then of the evolution of a modern firearm. And, for example, anyone who knows anything about firearms realize that they would much rather have a semi-automatic shotgun that held five rounds for an urban environment rather than an AK-47 that was semi-automatic. So who's going to make the decision on what type of weapons would be allowed and wouldn't be allowed?
Jerry, thanks for that. Carl Bogus, how about it? If we look at a collective right related to a militia, I mean, the kind of weapons that a militia or its equivalent today might use are pretty intimidating. You're right up there to shoulder-fired missiles before you know it. Does it matter if in terms of what kind of weaponry may be permitted or regulated? Does it matter if we look at the collective or the individual right interpretation?
Yes, it does matter, and the question is a terrific one, and I think allows me to clear up what might be a little bit confusing.
Mm.
In the individual rights model, if the right has been given as an ultimate check on governmental tyranny, and the people have therefore a right to arm themselves for possible war against U.S. military forces, then the right attaches with greater force to military weaponry, to machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades and WMDs than it would to a single-shot bolt-action 22. That, however, is the individual rights theory based upon final check on governmental tyranny. That would, if the court goes that way, turn reasonable regulation on its head. The more powerful the weaponry, the more unreasonable it would be to restrict it. Under the collective rights view, the militia-based view, the right has been given so that the states may have some minimum right to an armed militia to provide for their own security.
As a state.
That's the reason that the people have been given the right to keep and bear arms within the government-regulated militia.
What a picture. That's quite a spectrum. Our time is so short. I want to just turn that to Nick Rosenkranz for a moment, if I may. Do you see us, Professor Rosenkranz, headed toward, you know, even more lethal armaments potentially being green-lighted by where this Supreme Court is headed with the Second Amendment or not?
I'm very glad you turned to me, because I wouldn't want your listeners to be left with that impression at all. No one is arguing for shoulder-fired missiles. No one is arguing for weapons of mass destruction. No one is arguing for grenade launchers or anything like that. What's at issue in this case is handguns in the home for self-defense. So that's all Heller wants. He wants a pistol in his bedside drawer, so that he can protect himself if there's an intruder. That's all that's at issue in this case. I don't think the U.S. government, I don't think the Solicitor General, I don't think anyone who's filed a brief in this case thinks that any of those other weapons are at issue.
Tom, Carl Bogus, if I can just respond very briefly to that.
10 seconds.
That's correct. Nobody's arguing that, and the court certainly won't go that way. But I think that this demonstrates the incoherence of the individual rights view and what would be reasonable regulation under a view that, according to Heller and according to the D.C. Circuit Court, is in part based upon this insurrectionist right.
And with that, we're going to have to say, watch this space. Carl Bogus at Roger Williams University, Nicholas Rosenkranz at Georgetown, and Saul Cornell at Ohio State, thanks to all of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.